Hello, listeners of the Third Sector podcast. This is Emily.
And this is Lucinda.
And we just wanted to send you a massive thank you because this week, the Third Sector podcast hit a major milestone.
That's right. The podcast has now been downloaded more than 100,000 times.
It's incredible. And we are so proud of the podcast and we are so grateful to everybody who's contributed to it since we launched all the way back in 2019. And that's our fabulous hosts, our producers, the many guests who've joined us in the studio, and of course you, our listeners, for tuning in every week, subscribing and sharing episodes with your colleagues, friends, maybe even your family.
We couldn't do it without you. And if you'd like to take your support a little bit further, the easiest way is to hit the subscribe button. It takes less than a second and really would give us a boost. We'd also love it if you give us a rating on your preferred platform.
So from us and from the whole team at Third Sector, thank you so much for your support.
Hello and welcome to the Third Sector podcast. I'm Lucinda Rouse.
And I'm Emily Burt. Each week we bring you half an hour of discussion and debate about the important goings-on in the charity world. And this week we'll be joined by the digital specialist Zoe Amar and the British Heart Foundation's Head of Technology Strategy, who are going to bring us up to speed on the latest developments in artificial intelligence and how charities can proactively engage with it while also managing those associated risks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you might be thinking that you've been hearing quite a lot from the BHF recently. And you would be right, because we hosted the charity's chief executive, Charmaine Griffiths, last week. But it's the first time in a while that we've had the lovely folk at BHF on to join us. And in our opinion, you really cannot have too much of a good thing. But before we hear from our guests this week, we would like to take a couple of minutes to tell you about something new. Because alongside turning over Third Sector's weekly podcast, Lucinda, you've also been working on a pretty major new audio project. What's it all about?
It is about the end of charity.
Ooh.
Question mark.
Dun, dun, dun.
I appreciate that that will sound very ominous to our audience of charity management professionals, but fear not, we are not calling for an end of the whole charity system. No. This is going to be a six-part podcast documentary series featuring a range of voices from within the voluntary sector and also some critics and what you might call radicals. So we'll be looking at where charity has come from as a concept. We'll be joined by guests such as the philanthropy expert Rodri Davis of Why Philanthropy Matters to take us through charity's roots way back into medieval times, and then more recently in history, the Victorian era, where the concept of the haves giving and supporting the have-nots became an ingrained part of society, and with its close associations with religion and so on. I don't want to reveal too much because I would really like you to listen to all six parts, but we will be exploring new forms of doing good and forces for change within the philanthropy and charity world. You can expect to see appearances from the head of philanthropy at Mr. Beast, if anybody is familiar with this YouTube sensation, the biggest YouTuber in the world. And we'll also be exploring other ways of doing good through mutual aid groups, social enterprise and business for good, and a whole host of other things. So it's very exciting.
Absolutely. And, you know, the whole concept for this project, actually for us at Third Sector, dates all the way back to sort of 2018, 2019, when our former features and analysis writer Rebecca Cooney and the former editor of Third Sector, Andy Hillier, spoke to a series of, again, quite radical thought leaders at the time about the ways in which they thought fundraising was going to change in the future. And we'd planned, because it was such a popular series of articles, for a very long time to develop it and to turn it into something bigger. And this is where the kind of origins of the end of charity came from. We've seen the for good landscape change so much in the past 20 years. You talk about mutual aid, you talk about, you know, for good, B corporations, the rise of these movements. And of course, things like direct action, Extinction Rebellion, people from Just Stop Oil gluing themselves to the streets and throwing paint at paintings. And in this rapidly evolving world, and also at a time when we are seeing greater need and more pressure on the charitable sector than ever, I think it is such an interesting time to be exploring what this For Good landscape looks like. And as you've said, we have some terrific guests. We have Rodri Davis from Why Philanthropy Matters. We've got Martha Awajobi from JMB Consulting, and some big charity names as well. Emma Reeve from the Trussell Trust and Kolbasia Halsu from Freedom From Torture. I could go on. But instead of just listening to Lucinda and myself talking about this, we would love now for you to just have a listen to this trailer.
When you're seeing this scale of need and this scale of response, you have to question, what do we want for our society? What is our social contract?
The point that's really important thinking about charity as it is now in the UK is the Victorian era. Because that's where we have the model of charity as a way of the haves, essentially, giving to the have-nots.
There are around 200,000 charities in the UK. Some are run by a single person, others are multi-million pound operations, and they address almost every area of need you can think of. But it is a world with a complicated past.
You can really trace back the history of racism and the charity sector to colonialism and imperialism. When we look at historical figures who, you know, were philanthropists, who were giving money to schools and like really being seen in our country as these philanthropic, benevolent beings, and at the same time were prolific slave traders.
And charities today are wrangling with a whole set of other challenges.
Go and help the person directly. Don't do it through a charity. It's much more rewarding when you help the person directly.
Because you were dealing with Oxfam, you were dealing with a great British institution. It was a household name. It was very much part of the fabric of our society. It was going to be a huge story, a huge story.
So in a world where the need is greater than ever,
we probably were providing 10 years ago 50,000, 60,000 emergency food parcels, whereas last year food banks in our network provided just under 3 million emergency food parcels, 1 million of which were for children.
But the landscape for doing good has shifted dramatically. What does the future look like for charities?
Charities can't assume that they're the only game in town anymore. There are all of these other options.
I'm Lucinda Rouse, and this is The End of Charity. Hopefully that has tickled your taste buds for more of The End of Charity. The first episode will be released on Tuesday, the 19th of March. Moving on to this week's main discussion. How much are you making use of artificial intelligence at work? Is it something you've thought deeply about, or do you still feel like you're playing catch up? The release of ChatGPT at the end of November 2022 marked something of a watershed moment for generative AI. And the latest Charity Digital Skills report has noted an explosion of interest in AI in the past year, with many charity respondents questioning whether they should be making use of it at all, and if so, how. More than a quarter already were, but three quarters said they didn't feel prepared to respond to the opportunities and challenges that AI presents. Now, we hosted a podcast episode last April about charities and ChatGPT, so we felt that now is the right time to revisit the subject and see how things have come on.
Yes, and we are very pleased to be joined by Zoe Amar, who is the founder and director of Zoe Amar Digital, which produces the Charity Digital Skills Report. And Zoe is, of course, also a regular columnist for Third Sector. And she's providing support to charities and not-for-profits who are preparing themselves for AI, among other digital areas. So, Zoe, it's great to have you with us.
Hello.
Hello. To kick off, could you please just give us a quick recap in your eyes of the developments that you've seen in the AI space over the past year since we were last talking about ChatGPT in April 2023?
Absolutely. And it's great timing because I was listening to that episode of your podcast again last night. So there's three things that I would pick out. So since April 2023, obviously, one of the big things that's happened is we've seen the AI Safety Summit, which took place in the UK last autumn. And that to me revealed some of the prevailing tensions we're already seeing around AI. You know, there's people who believe that AI will take all jobs like Elon Musk, and those who think that such long-term threats are kind of overblown. But what came out of that for civil society, which I think is a really significant development, was more than 100 civil society groups, including Amnesty International and Liberty, signed a statement saying that they were concerned that the sector had been sidelined by the summer. So some noise starting to happen in that area, quite rightly. And then a couple of other things that I'd pick out are obviously one of the big things we've seen since spring of last year is the introduction of these virtual assistants. So Microsoft Copilot. So some of your listeners will be starting to use that. So essentially an AI-powered assistant that's integrated into Microsoft's 365 tools, helping professionals be more productive. And Google has just launched a similar AI assistant tool called Google Gemini, which we're just trialing at the moment in our organization, actually. So there's that. There's AI starting to become more integrated into our working lives. And then I think that third point actually really builds on that, because the way in which charities are talking to us about AI over the last year has really started to change. And we're going to take the temperature on that in the Charity Digital Skills Report survey for the 2024 report. And we've just launched that survey, so we'd love to hear from your listeners there. And really, how I'd characterise that change, and this is anecdotal at this stage because we don't yet have the data on that, obviously, is that it feels much more normalised to talk to charities about AI. So for example, I was talking to a charity leader the other week who's saying, yeah, I always have ChatGPT open on one tab. And if I get a bit stuck with something, I might ask it to help me write an email, or I might ask it a question. And for me, that really illustrates how this change is starting to get embedded. For me, real disruption is not about the big shiny product launch or even a similar charity doing a big game-changing AI service. Significant though those things are, for me, real disruption is when change begins to get normalized. And I wonder whether we're starting to get towards that point with AI. So I'm really excited to find out more about that this year.
Brilliant. And there's, in the terminology when we're talking about AI and how people are reacting to it, the two words that I see a lot are response. How are people responding to AI? And then how are people engaging with AI? And thinking specifically about response, to what extent do you think there's a need for a collective response at the sector level?
So I really do think we need a sector-wide response, and I can say a bit about why that is. And for me, I think this is very unique to the sector and what it does. So what do we know about AI? We don't know the exact extent of the change or what the speed of the change will look like, but all the prevailing trends indicate that those who are at the sharp end of social justice could be adversely affected by it. So that could be people who are in so-called low-skilled jobs in retail and hospitality. So it could mean that there is greater demand for the sector's work as some of those jobs get automated. And I think that AI adoption could also have a significant impact on the sector itself. So if we look at what the sector does, so service delivery, information advice, research, really big parts of what the sector do, and all of those areas are things which could get automated, looking at what's happening in other sectors such as banking and retail and energy. And then there are other things which I think are very much resonate with the sector's ethical concerns. So things like algorithmic bias, data privacy, which we really do need to have a voice on as a sector. And of course, there are some long-standing issues that affect digital transformation, which were there even before ChatGPT got launched. So such as the fact that board digital skills are low and there's a lack of funding for digital as well. And of course, our sector is so squeezed at the moment because of cost of living. So I think that is why we really need to have a sector-wide response so we can learn together, we can plan together, and we can work out how as a sector we should really be responding to this so that we can continue to support the people who could be impacted by it, but also so that we don't do harm by adopting these tools in the wrong way.
Absolutely. And I think just jumping off everything you've said there about those very broad reasons ethically why this is so important, there are also lots of practical, much more macro reasons why organisations need to be really proactive on this front. And Zoe, you and I have spoken quite a bit about AI so far already this year. And one of my favourite phrases, which I have absolutely taken from you, is the phrase stealth IT. And I think this is a really, really important thing for organizations to be mindful of. So can you talk to our listeners a little bit about what exactly it is you mean around the phrase stealth IT when you use that, and how that relates to organizations having to be really proactive when it comes to artificial intelligence and to other new developing technologies within their own walls?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this relates to the point I was making earlier about how disruption can be a kind of creep of these tools into an organization rather than the big bang. So stealth IT has been around for a while. I didn't coin the term. It's also known as grey IT, but it's where you obviously have the official tools that are sanctioned by your organization. But stealth IT is where people start to bring in tools that they just find useful or help improve their productivity. So a case like this might be the organization, you know, not having a position on whether you can use ChatGPT or not, but there might be a team who start to use it. And often it's with very positive intentions. It's about, I want to have more impact, I want to be more productive, I want to do more. But if your organization doesn't have clear parameters for its staff around what data you do and don't put on these tools, what you do and don't use them for, then that's where things can start to get a bit messy. So someone with the best will in the world might put some sensitive data in there, for example, or use the tools in an inappropriate way. And I have to admit, part of me is quite torn about stealth IT, because I do like innovation, I like staff to be empowered and to do things differently. But at the same time, because of the risks that come with what charities do, then I think it's very important to make sure that you've got a clear organisational position and policy on what staff can and can't do. And this is about giving them support. It's not necessarily about punishing people. So that is going to become even more prevalent, I think, even more important in the age of AI, because there are so many of these tools coming on stream now and so many integrations. And that's why charities really need to get a handle on what their staff are using and what they're using it for, and what the learnings are as well.
I was wondering if any parallels could be drawn or lessons taken from other sector level responses or forms of engagement or just general approach to artificial intelligence.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a really interesting parallel going on in the education sector. So there's a new body called AI in Education. And where I think there's some parallels with the charity sector is they have basically identified two or three key areas where they can make a difference based on their strengths. So it's essentially a group of head teachers, quite high profile head teachers, who've got together. But critically, it's also a cross sector effort. So they've got some of the UK's leading scientists and technologists involved from Google and Cambridge University, as well as all these amazing educationists and teachers. And they're focusing on plagiarism and how AI tools can be developed so they're in the interests of young people, and how they give teachers the right advice about AI. And where I think there are parallels with what we could do as a sector is if we could identify two or three key areas where our expertise could make a difference as a sector, and then look at where we can come together as a sector and start to make a difference in those areas. So that could be about starting to lobby more on how these tools can be developed in more of an ethical way so that they don't cause harm. It could be about starting to scenario plan for some of these big changes that are going to affect marginalized groups that could come with the further adoption of AI. It's really about looking at where we can make the biggest difference as a sector, where we're going to be needed, and planning ahead for that.
So we've talked quite high level so far, but through your work leading the Charity Digital Skills Report and also wider discussions with charities thinking about AI and how they can use it and the risks that are associated with that, I was wondering if you could give us a couple of examples of different ways in which charities can start to engage with and make use of AI, and particularly organizations which perhaps don't have the resource for big investments, but just want to start playing on a low budget level.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the classic way in which a lot of smaller charities are getting started with AI is using it for administrative tasks. And as we all know, those can take up a lot of time. So that could be things like summarising meeting notes or developing online content, so writing social media posts or generating images. And then I see that once charities get more confident with that, then you can move on to more advanced and ambitious ways of using these tools. So I've spoken to charities who have used AI tools for writing funding bids, actually, so grant fundraising. So if you go on a Charity Excellence Framework's website, they actually have some great resources to help people do that. And I think there are also charities who are using these tools for research and information gathering. So, of course, there's the challenge there about, is the information accurate? How can we make sure that we're not just totally relying on this as one source of information and building in time for fact checking and editing? But if you're a charity that, say, produces reports or research, and you want to analyse some raw data, and of course you can use AI for analysing numerical data as well, then that can be a really good way to save time. So the number one piece of advice I'd give to charities there is to start small, but to learn quickly and to look at what other staff are doing when using these tools, where it works for you as an organisation, where it doesn't work for you, and then gradually starting to be a bit more ambitious, but always thinking about what your parameters are around, is this the right thing to do? And do we have clarity on where our data is going as well? So being innovative, I'd say, and being open to experimenting and learning together, but at the same time, always thinking about where your comfort levels are in line with your values and your charitable purpose.
So much to think about there. It is very opportune that we are joined today by another guest as well from a charity. So we're delighted to be joined by Karin Marta, who's the Head of Technology Strategy at the British Heart Foundation. Hi, Karin.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining us. And I wondered if you could, building on what Zoe has just been talking about, sort of tell us how the British Heart Foundation is making use of AI at the moment.
Yeah, of course. And I've been nodding along to everything Zoe's been saying because I'm just in complete agreement. So at the British Heart Foundation, we've been on a bit of an AI journey, definitely since the ChatGPT launch. We've had warm enthusiasts who've kind of been exploring themselves. But what I'd say is over the last 5 or 6 months, we've been bringing in a bit more structure for how we support people with safely exploring the use of AI. So we've brought in and created an AI working group, as well as establishing an AI community. The AI community is where we want people across the organisation to be able to share learning successes, interesting reports on AI, just all that thing around information. Whereas the working group is more of a formal structure group of individuals, again, across the BHF, with the focus of looking more at education, governance, and how we assess value against AI. And since then, we've been on a bit of a journey to create a strategy to support usage. So we find ourselves in an interesting situation. We are building the plane whilst flying it. So the strategy is there to be directional and provide some structure, but we also want to learn as we go and learn quickly, exactly as Zoe mentioned. That's the key thing here. We know we don't know very much and we want to learn through doing as much as possible, but we recognise we need that safe infrastructure guardrails around it so that we can make sure we're being responsible and ethical in how we use AI.
So I think that really kind of bounces off everything that Zoe was saying. And actually, when you're thinking about this, so much of it comes down to environment and it comes down to culture. So Karin, you talked about safely exploring, which I think is a great, you know, way to look at it. It's not about being prescriptive. It's not about being limiting when you're putting these structures in place. It's saying we want to give you the space to innovate, but also making sure, as Zoe was saying, we are aligning with the charity's values and with the charity's purpose and processes. So that sounds like a very interesting environment to be in. Do you have any examples of practically actually what AI is doing for the British Heart Foundation at the moment?
I do. So Zoe summed up really nicely around there's lots of different ways that we could approach AI. But for us at the BHF, we see it in two camps. So we've got the everyday AI around exploring where AI can bring value in relation to productivity-based activities. And then we've got the more game-changing AI. So where can it be more disruptive, novel, and maybe completely overhaul what we're doing or how we do it? What I'd say is we are open to both types of AI exploration, but we are predominantly focusing on the everyday AI usage. So what we're seeing is users. So we are in a trial at the moment with Microsoft's Copilot. And so we are exploring how, through a small cohort at the moment of 300 users, how users can use Copilot to win back time on administrative tasks, just like Zoe mentioned, around recording meetings, turning meeting transcripts into minutes. Tasks that used to take maybe a couple of hours are being completed within about 15 minutes. People are able to attend more meetings, even join meetings late because of the recap functionality that Copilot provides, as well as being better prepared for meetings, so that rather than meetings maybe being structured to share a lot of information up front and then have some discussion, by having better use of pre-read functionality through Copilot, we're jumping straight into discussions. So meetings are becoming more efficient as well through the use of the Copilot features. So they're just some of the examples that we're seeing coming through a bit more consistently. And again, as Zoe mentioned, it's all about how people are sharing their learnings, best practice, but also where it's maybe not working as well or not bringing the benefits. That's just as beneficial, understanding where it hasn't been as successful for us yet.
And I appreciate it's really early days. You've got a limited number of people involved in this pilot, and you've only been using Microsoft Copilot for, 2-3 months now. But I wondered if you could share any particularly interesting findings off the back of that usage, both positive and negative.
Yes. So again, I'll heavily caveat that it's a small cohort currently, and we're still surfacing the insight. But so far, we're seeing really positive indicators from the value being generated so far from the small trial we've done. And what I mean by that is, at a really high level, we're finding that the more senior the role, the greater the return on investment that we've made. We're seeing that for all users, there is a return on investment, which is great news to hear. And we're seeing it in terms of generating content, speeding that process up so that people aren't starting from a blank piece of paper as such. So we're seeing a lot of positive feedback and time saved around that. We're seeing savings in relation to meetings, as I've already mentioned, be it the duration of meetings significantly reducing. And we're also seeing time saved in relation to using Copilot as a search agent. It's speeding up how people are bringing themselves information and getting familiar in perhaps new topics.
Well, that sounds really, really exciting. And I must say, your job and your job title in general sounds like a really brilliant one to have. And you're at a very exciting moment testing things and then also thinking about what might come next. So can you tell us anything about what the plan is for expanding the AI usage at the BHF going forward? Anything new that you're looking to get into?
Yes. So what I'd say, full transparency, we don't know exactly where we're going with AI. It's such a fast-paced world, and we know we're not the experts in it. And our strategy is set up to be agile and allow us to, it sets a direction. And we have a current vision of we want to enhance what we're doing at the BHF through AI, but we're prepared to change as we need to when we learn more with AI. So at the moment, we're kind of positioning ourselves as seeing AI as it's a learning culture change that we're on. We want to increase awareness about what AI is across the BHF over the next 12 to 18 months. We want to make it accessible to everyone who wants to use it to enhance what they're doing and try and add value where they can to what they're doing. And we think through greater awareness and greater use of AI in a safe way, we think we will get more value from our everyday AI activities, but we will also start to unlock, hopefully, more opportunities within that game-changing space. We're already seeing, for people who've been involved with AI a bit longer and who are warm to AI at the BHF, we're already seeing some of those big meaty problems, probably in the game-changing space. They're starting to explore whether AI could help. So we're seeing things in our retail area in relation to AI and the way that it could support and enhance what we do in terms of our logistics and how it could improve the customer experience as well, which improves how customers perceive the BHF and will hopefully return and come back to us. So that's where we think there could be some huge gains for us. But the big caveat is data. That will be the big thing that we need to make sure is a foundation that's in place for us to be able to explore those game-changing things, which is another big cultural shift and change that we're working through at the moment as well.
I mean, yeah, data can be a whole other podcast episode in its own right for the charity sector. Maybe we'll bring both of you back at some point to discuss that. But one final question then from me. Zoe, I know that earlier you spoke about the fact that sometimes boards can be a little slower in the adoption of new technologies, in the adoption of digital. You've both spoken about the idea of people who are very sort of warm and enthusiastic about these tech. And there are, of course, other people who are slightly more risk averse and are more cautious around it. So for my final question to both of you, I would love to know if you were part of a charity that is trying to make the case, be it to senior leadership, or be it to a board who are feeling a bit cautious about AI at the moment, and you wanted to kind of make the case for why it's important to be proactive in this space right now, what would your quick fire key arguments be on this?
Yeah, great question. So there's two things I would suggest here, and I've tried and tested these with trustees. If anyone wants to borrow this, please go for it. So the first thing I do is you have to make the tangible nature of this technology real. So the way that AI gets talked about a lot in the media can feel very hyperbolic, as we were saying. If you can say to people, actually, you're using this technology all the time. So you might have used it to unlock your phone this morning using facial recognition. You might have bought a book on Amazon recently and got served product recommendations for similar customers, bought similar books. You know, that's machine learning, which is a type of AI. So more you can give people some everyday real examples, that starts to make the impact of this technology real. And then the second thing which will make that impact even more real is if you can show how other organizations, whether they're in the same space or comparable organizations, are using these technologies. So maybe if you're a health charity, another health charity or some other, or a healthcare provider is using these tools and what they're achieving with it as well. So I think a little bit of healthy competition and seeing that these things are very much on trustees' doorsteps, even if they might not think they are, is a really good way to bring the message home on both of those fronts.
Just to add to what Zoe's saying, I think the other factor that I'd recommend is bringing AI back to value. What is the value that it can add? So for me, I think leadership are most receptive. There's lots of different agendas and viewpoints across the leadership group, right? But the one thing that they're all looking for is what's the value, what's the impact that something can drive. So if you can articulate AI in terms of value, that will really help them understand why something is going to be helpful or why it should be brought in. And it'll also help navigate the understandable hype that there potentially is around AI at the moment. We're currently going through a lot of noise around AI tools. It's probably going to become an even busier space. So if you can fall back on a solid foundation of value and evidence to suggest why you should go for something, that's going to serve you really well as the hype continues around AI, I think.
So much food for thought. And this is a discussion that we will no doubt be coming back to again and again. Zoe and Karen, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. Next week, we'll be delving into the history of fundraising with Marina Jones, the Deputy Development Director at the ENO. And don't miss the launch of The End of Charity coming up before then. Episode 1 will be released on the 19th of March. But for now, thanks to our guests and our producers, Till Owen and Nav Powell.